other baby growing inside her. "How were your last days in the Hamptons?" she asked him in the kitchen as she and Anna waited for the chefs to hand them the first appetizers.
"Boring,"
Mighty said.
"You did not have any fun after I left?"
"Not really."
"But now I feel bad, Mighty,"
Nenny said, inflating her cheeks to make a funny, sad face.
"Your mom really wanted me to take off my last 2 days. But next time, I will stay, if that is what Mr. Mighty demands."
"I'll demand,"
Mighty said.
"Yes, sir. Or maybe you'll come with me to Harlem instead. That way we can continue making Puff Puff for breakfast in the morning and playing soccer on the beach in the evening. Do you want that instead, Mr. Mighty?"
"Really? It'll be so cool to go to Harlem. But hold on, there's no beach in Harlem."
"Then we will... I will..."
"We'll watch stupid movies, and I'll beat you at PlayStation and arm wrestling every time,"
Mighty said, laughing, a twinkle in his hazel eyes.
"You should never be proud that you beat a woman," Nenny said, contorting her face to feign indignation as she picked up a tray of appetizers. "Come, everyone is going to start eating."
As she walked the appetizers around the room before setting the leftovers on the table, she smiled and nodded at Cindy's friends, all of whom she'd met in the Hamptons. They had been kind and polite to her, offering her advice on the benefits of prenatal yoga, and telling her where the best yoga studios in the city were. "Thank you so much for the information, madame," she always said, reminding her it was okay for her to call them by their first names, something she could never do, being that it was a mark of disrespect in Limbe. Complimenting her smooth skin and lovely smile. "Your skin is so smooth and beautiful too, madame. You have a lovely smile too, madame." Wondering how long it took her to get her braids done. "Only 8 hours, madame." Their friendliness had surprised her. She'd expected indifference from them. These kinds of women who walked around with authentic Gucci and Versace bags and talked about spas and vacations and the opera. Based on movies she'd seen, in which rich white people ate and drank and laughed with nary a glance at the maids and servers running around them, she'd imagined that women who owned summer houses in the Hamptons wouldn't have anything to say to her, besides ordering her around, of course. After she'd met no fewer than 4 of them, all of whom had smiled at her and asked how far along she was in her pregnancy, she'd spoken about this unexpected congeniality with Betty, and she and Betty had agreed that the women's behavior was likely due to the fact that it wasn't every day they met a beautiful pregnant Cameroonian woman from Harlem. Such women couldn't possibly be kind and polite to every housekeeper, they surmised. Cindy, on that Sunday afternoon, was the kindest and politest of them all, reminding Nenny to do only the easiest work and make sure she didn't overexert herself. Watching Cindy chatting with her friends and laughing with her head thrown back, Nenny had to convince herself that the strange episodes in the Hamptons had indeed happened.
"We have to talk about Cindy,"
Anna whispered in her ear in the kitchen.
"What?"
Nenny quickly asked. "What is wrong with her?" Anna pulled her by the arm to the far end of the kitchen, away from the chefs and the guests entering and exiting, the plates of egg white omelets and glasses of smoothies.
"She got problems,"
Anna whispered.
"Problems? You don't see no problems in the Hamptons?"
Nenny opened her mouth but said nothing.
"You see something in the Hamptons, no?"
Anna said, nodding rapidly.
"You see it?"
"I don't know,"
Nenny said, confused by the direction of the conversation.
"I come in the morning for work and she's smelling alcohol,"
Anna whispered, waving her hand in front of her face as if to disperse an invisible smell.
"Yes,"
Nenny said.
"She likes wine."
The housekeeper shook her head.
"This is not liking wine. This is problem. But last week, I look in the garbage. 3 empty bottles of wine. Mighty do not drink wine. Clark is not home. I see him 1-2 times every week. Maybe..."
"Can someone please refill the punch for the kids and get some more napkins?"
one of the chefs called out. Anna gestured for Nenny to stay put while she took care of it.
To be honest, Nenny whispered when Anna returned, I saw it in the Hamptons too.
Ah, I know I'm not crazy.
I didn't know a woman can drink like that.
This family has problems. Big problems.
She wasn't like this before?
No. Before, she drank like normal person. Little here, little there.
22 years I work for them, and I see no problems like this. But always they have other problems. They're eating dinner, not too much talking. You don't see them fight too many times. You don't see them happy too many times.
You think he knows? Nenny asked, looking over her shoulder. Anna shook her head.
He don't know anything. No one knows. See how she looks out there. How can people know if they don't see the bottles?
Nenny sighed. She wanted to tell Anna about the pills, but thought it would be no use further upsetting her. The alcohol was bad enough.
Maybe one day she'll just stop, she said. One day people don't stop drinking, Anna quickly replied. They drink and drink and drink. But we cannot do anything.
No, don't talk like that,
the housekeeper said, shaking her head so vigorously the two clumps of hair that made up her bang swung away from her forehead.
We cannot say we cannot do anything, because something happened to her.
Then what about us?
A man in my town he drink until one day he die. If she die, who will write me check, or your husband check?
Nenny almost burst out laughing, half at Anna's reasoning and half at the way she was so terribly and unnecessarily afraid. Lots of people in Limbe drank 7 days a week, and she'd never heard of alcohol killing any of them. One of her uncles was even known as the best drunkard in Bonjo. He serenaded the whole neighborhood to Eboalotin tunes on his best drunken days. And yet, he was still living on in Limbe.
You think it's little thing?
Anna said.
But I know people lose the job because the family got big problem. My friend with family in Tribeca, she lose her job last month.
Oh, Papa God,
Nenny gasped, moving her hand to her chest.
You are scaring me now. I know Cindy for many years,
Anna went on.
Ever since her mother died 4 years.
You knew her mother?
Yes, I know her. She come to the house 4-5 times. Bad woman. Bad, bad woman. You see the way she talk to Cindy? Angry with her. Nothing make her happy.
No wonder.
But Cindy's sister, the child of the mother's husband who died long ago, the mother always nice to her. When they come together, everything the bad woman say to the sister is sweetie this, sweetie that. But with Cindy,
Anna shook her head.
I'd cut that kind of person out of my life if it was me.
No.
Cindy goes to see her for Mother's Day every year, and the bad woman dies.
Why? Why you ask me?
I don't know why. And this Mother's Day, Mighty comes to me, telling me he's sad, because his family no longer go to Virginia for Mother's Day, because he wants to see his cousins there. I want to shout at him and say, you want to go back to Virginia for what? Cindy's sister, ever since their mother died, I never see her again in the house. Cindy, she has no family now, except for the boys and Clark.
But she has a lot of friends.
Friends is family,
Anna said.
Friends is not family.
Out in the living room, Cindy was laughing, perhaps amused by a story a friend was telling. How could anyone have so much happiness and unhappiness skillfully wrapped up together? Nenny wondered.
We got to tell Clark about the alcohol,
Anna said.
No, we cannot.
Dessert is ready to be served, the second chef called out. Nenny hurried to take out the desserts while Anna cleared the entrees.
We don't have to be the ones to tell him,
Nenny said after they'd returned to their corner.
He'll find out. Maybe you can leave the empty wine bottles on the table for him to see. How he's going to see when he's not home? And she will know that I'm trying to do something if I just go take bottle out of trash can and put on the table. You have to be the one to tell him first.
Me?
We do it together. If I alone I tell him, he will not think it is serious problem. But if you tell him too, he knows it's serious. Just tell him somebody was drinking too much wine in Hamptons. You don't know who. He is smart man, he will know. And he will tell her, and she will know it's me. No man is stupid like that. After you tell him next week I too, I'll tell him the same thing about some person drinking the wine in the apartment. Then he'll know it's really true. He can do what he wants to do. We know our hands are clean.
Nenny walked to the kitchen island, picked up a bottle of water, and gulped down half of it. Maybe Anna was right, she thought. Maybe they had to do the right thing and warn Clark. But she didn't think it was ever right to get involved in other people's marriages. Marriage already being complicated and full of woes as it was. But Anna had made a good point. Clark was working all the time and would never know the extent of what his wife was going through. The whole time Nenny was in the Hamptons, she'd seen him in person only on the days of the cocktail parties, where he and Cindy had acted as if they slept in the same bed every night. At the first cocktail party, which was to celebrate Cindy's 50th birthday, they had floated around the pool hand in hand, smiling and hugging guests in the warm candlelit evening, as a string quartet played on. Cindy, in an orange backless dress and blow-dried hair, looked like Gwyneth Paltrow that night, maybe even more beautiful, and certainly not much older. Toward the end of the party, they had stood with their arms around each other, flanked on either side by their handsome sons, as Cindy's friends toasted her, speaking of what a wonderful and selfless friend she was. Cherie tearfully told of the evening she'd called Cindy crying, because her mother had fallen at her nursing home in Stamford and needed surgery the next day, and Cherie couldn't be there because she was stuck at work in San Francisco. As an only child, Cherie told the guests, it was hard, really hard, but on that day Cindy made it easy for her. Cindy offered to be there for her mother and took a 5 a.m. train from Grand Central to Stamford. She stayed at the hospital until the three-hour surgery was over, and Cherie's mother was comfortably settled in her room. Cindy wasn't just her best friend, Cherie said, choking back tears. Cindy was her sister. The guests, tanned and clad in designer labels, smiled and clapped as Cherie walked over to Cindy, and the friends held each other in a prolonged hug. Clark asked everyone to raise their glasses. There wasn't much he could add to what Cindy's friends had said, he said, except that it was all true. Cindy was a gem. And my, was she the hottest 35-year-old or what? Everyone laughed, including Vince, who hadn't been smiling much all evening. To Cindy, they cheered. To Cindy. Nenny couldn't tell if Clark had spent that night there, but she knew that the next morning he was gone, as was Cindy's ceaseless smile from the evening before. When Nenny asked Mighty during lunch where his father was, Mighty, without looking up from his plate, had said only one word, work. He had finished his lunch in silence, and as Nenny was cleaning his plate, muttered,
I hope he loses his job.
Nenny had shaken her head, unable to decipher Clark Edwards. Why was he always working? How could anyone love work that much? Working nonstop made no sense whatsoever, especially when a man had such a nice family at home. Clark had to know what he was doing to his family and why he was doing it, but still, it would be good for him to know how unhappy his wife was, because that had to be the reason she was drinking excessively. Nenny's mother had told her that unhappiness was the only reason people drank too much, and that it was the reason her uncle drank too much, though no one could understand how he could be so unhappy when he had 2 wives and 11 children.
Go talk to him now,
Anna whispered to Nenny.
After dessert, everyone start to leave.
Nenny nodded and began walking toward the living room. She wasn't going to tell Mr. Edwards anything about the pills. That had to be Cindy's deepest secret, and she had to keep the promise she made. She was going to say only what Anna had told her to say. Tell Mr. Edwards about the wine. Nothing more and nothing less. But then, as she was about to enter the living room, she remembered something. Jende. She turned around and went back to Anna.
Jende will kill me, she said. For what? For putting my mouth in their business. He never stops wanting me to just do my work and leave. I never say anything that doesn't concern me. Then don't tell him nothing. This is only me and you. Go.
Clark was standing alone by the window, looking outside either at traffic on West End or kayakers on the Hudson River. Nenny picked up a tray of scones and walked toward him.
Hi, Mr. Edwards, she said. Sorry I did not say good morning to you yet.
Hi, Nenny, Clark said. Thanks for helping out. He looked down at the scones. I'm going to pass on that, thanks.
Should I bring you another kind of dessert?
He shook his head. 2 weeks since she'd last seen him, and he appeared to be a different man. His hair seemed to have gone thinner. His face was unshaven, and he looked as if he needed a hug, a cozy bed, and at least 15 hours blocked out to do nothing but sleep. He turned his face back to the window and continued looking outside. Nenny stood with the tray, staring at the blank white wall to the left of the window, unsure of how to say what she wanted to say. Cindy was at the other end of the room, chatting on the sofa with two of her friends. The husbands were thumbing their Blackberries and iPhones. The children were in another room. The timing and setting for her to tell Clark was ideal.
Mr. Edwards,
she began. Yeah? Clark said, still looking out the window.
I just needed to ask you a question.
Sure, he said, without turning around to face her.
It's just that, I have always wanted to know, are you related to John Edwards?
Clark turned around, chuckling. No, not that I know of. But that's funny. You're the first person to ask me that.
I just think that maybe he looks like you a little bit,
Nenny said, rubbing her elbow against her belly at the spot where the baby was kicking her, perhaps for being so boneheaded. That's funny, Clark said, before suggesting that she go offer the scones to others, in case they were interested in trying them. Nenny nodded and ran back to the kitchen.
How did it go?
Anna asked her. Nenny shook her head and buried her face against the refrigerator.
You don't tell him.
She shook her head again.
Well,
Anna said,
we tried.
Chapter 25. She spent the day cleaning the apartment, shopping for groceries, and preparing a 5-course farewell dinner for Vince. All afternoon, she stayed in the kitchen, making a goosey stew with smoked turkey, gari and okra soup, fried ripe plantains and beans, jollof rice with chicken gizzard, and ekwang, which took 2 hours to make because she had to peel the cocoyams, grate them, tightly and painstakingly wrap teaspoons of the grated cocoyam into spinach leaves, then simmer in a pot with palm oil, dried fish, crayfish, salt, pepper, maggi, and bush onions for an hour. She would have preferred if Jende had given her more time to prepare, but he'd told her only the night before that Vince was coming over. He had asked Clark, while dropping him off at home, if it was okay for him and Nenny to have Vince over for a little dinner, just to wish him well and have him eat some Cameroonian food, which he'd said he'd love to try, and Clark had said he had no objection if Vince was interested. He and Cindy were taking Vince and Mighty out to dinner on Sunday, but it was unlikely it was going to be a festive farewell dinner, so Vince might as well go somewhere where there would be more merrymaking. When Jende had called Vince to invite him, Vince had said sure, he would actually be free for a couple of hours in the evening, so he would be down for some sweet Cameroonian food. Thanks, man.
At 3 o'clock, 2 hours before Vince was supposed to arrive, Jende's phone rang, and it was Vince.
"I don't know, Vince," Nanny heard Jende say in the living room. "Let me first ask my wife what she thinks."
His hands over the mouthpiece, Jende came to Nanny in the kitchen.
"Vince wants to know if it's okay for him to bring Mighty."
"No.
That's what I told him."
"God forbid. You want Mrs. Edwards to kill us? Her baby in Harlem, in the evening? Please, God, oh,
I'm not participating. No, no, no. I don't want any trouble whatsoever."
Jende went back into the living room, spoke to Vince for a half minute, and came back.
"He says his parents don't have to know. Mr. Edwards is at work, and Mrs. Edwards is at a dinner something, and they are not going to know anything. He says Mighty had a play date, but the play date cancelled, so he's just going to spend all evening sitting at home with his nanny."
"Let him do that, then."
Jende turned to walk away, but hesitated.
"Let the child come, Nanny," he said.
"I said no."
"He's never been on the subway. He's never been to Harlem. Let his brother bring him.
Vince is leaving next week, and they will not see each other again for who knows how long. And it's only for 1 hour."
"And you don't think something bad can happen in 1 hour?" Nanny said,
sweating over the stove as she scrubbed off the grime from all the cooking and frying.
"If something happens, it'll be on Vince's head. I'll tell him that."
"That's what you are going to say when they try to put us in prison."
"Don't worry. I'll go to prison alone for both of us," he said, winking at her.
Nanny turned her face away and continued scrubbing the stove with greater fervor. Just like him to think he knew the answers. She heard him tell Vince that it was okay. They were all excited to see them at 5 o'clock, and later tell Leomi that the special guest they'd spoken about was bringing another guest, so he better go change into even nicer clothes. By the time Vince and Mighty arrived, Nanny had showered and changed her clothes too, and her mood was far more excited than fearful.
"Nanny!"
Mighty said when she opened the door, rushing to hug her.
"What are you guys doing in my house?"
she teased them as Vince gave her a hug and stooped to high-five Leomi.
"I can't believe I'm in Harlem," Mighty said. "Did you make Puff Puff?"
Nanny and Jende laughed.
"That's for breakfast," Jende said. "This evening, we have food that you will eat and your belly will get so full it will explode."
"Cool."
If the Edwards boys were fazed by the obvious signs of poverty in the apartment, the worn-out brown carpet, the retro TV sitting on a coffee table across from the sofa, the fan in the corner struggling to do the job of an AC, the fake flowers hanging on the wall and doing nothing to brighten the living room, they did not show it. They acted as if they were in any of the apartments they'd visited on Park or Madison, as if it were just a different kind of beautiful apartment in a different kind of nice neighborhood. Mighty ran to the bedroom with Leomi to see Leomi's toys and called out to his brother that, "Wow, everyone gets to sleep in the same bedroom here. How cool!" Vince sat with Jende on the faded green sofa, drinking Malta and eating roasted peanuts with him, talking about America the good country, America the bad country, America the country that no one could argue was the most powerful country in the world. When Nanny was done putting the food and serving dishes and placing them on the table, Jende announced it was time to eat. "We are going to eat Cameroon style," he said to Vince and Mighty. "In Cameroon, we do not usually sit around the table like you do in America. Everyone takes their food and sits where they like, on a chair, on the floor. They eat how they like, with a spoon or a fork, or with their hands."
"I want to sit on the floor and eat with my hands," Mighty said.
And Leomi immediately added that he wanted to do the same thing. So Nanny put a tablecloth on the floor, moved the food from the table, and they all sat in a circle on the floor and ate, laughing out loud with full mouths as Jende told them stories of his boyhood. Like how he and Winston used to go stealing mangoes when they were 11, and how one time his foot got caught in an animal trap, and he had to run all the way back home with a trap stuck to his foot, only to arrive and have his father beat him before going to fetch the man who owned the trap to come take it off. Vince chuckled, and Mighty and Leomi laughed so hard they almost choked. But Nani only rolled her eyes because she'd heard the story before, and every time the story had a different ending.
"Papa has the best stories,"
Leomi exclaimed.
"I want to hear more,"
Mighty said. Vince looked at his watch, then at Jende and Nani, and shook his head.
"I'm sorry, bud. We've got to leave now."
"Why?"
"I'm sorry. I've got other plans. I've got to take you back home to Stacy."
"But Nani?"
Mighty cried, looking at Nani, who averted her gaze.
Vince stood up and walked to the kitchen to wash his hands.
"I don't want to go back just yet,"
Mighty said to Jende and Nani, looking beseechingly from one to the other.
"Please, can I stay a little longer?"
"Your mother and father will not be happy, Mighty," Jende said.
"But they won't even be back home till after midnight. Dad may not even come back till tomorrow, and Mom said she might not be home till after 2 in the morning. I heard her tell Stacy that. So I can stay till 10 or 11, and they won't even know it."
"I'm sorry, bud," Vince said, coming out of the kitchen. "I've got other plans. This was fun, right? I'll pick you up Monday evening, and we'll do something fun again, okay?"
Mighty did not respond. He pouted and turned his face away, rubbing his fingers, which were fully covered with palm oil from the Ekwang.
"Maybe I'll come to your house for a playdate too,"
Leomi said to Mighty, perhaps in an attempt to cheer him up, or perhaps because Mighty had mentioned that he had the latest and cooler model of some of the toys Leomi had, most of which Cindy had given Nani. Whatever his intention, he said it so sweetly and sincerely that Nani almost laughed, but seeing how upset Mighty was, thought it best not to openly laugh at her child's innocence, in believing he would someday get an invite to a playdate at the Edwardses. But then, she thought, she couldn't be so sure Cindy wouldn't invite Leomi over. Without ever meeting Leomi, Cindy had been sending him toys and clothes, some of them brand new. When Leomi had come down with a case of pneumonia barely a month after Jende started working for them, Cindy had sent Jende home one evening with a basket of fruits and teas and healthy snacks. She'd written Leomi a letter after he sent her a handmade thank you card, praising his handwriting, and saying Jende must be doing a great job raising him.
"Why can't Jende take me home later?"
Mighty asked, still pouting and ignoring Vince's pleas to stand up and wash his hands.
"I'm going to go home, and it's going to be boring sitting..."
"But you told me you have fun with Stacy," Nani said.
"Yeah, but not this kind. Please, Nani, we didn't even get to make Puff Puff."
"Maybe I'll come back to the Hamptons next summer," Nani said. "Then we'll get to do everything all over again, right?"
"Yeah, yeah."
Jende stood up and held out his hand to Mighty to help him stand up. "There will be another time, Mighty," he said to the boy. "By the grace of God, there will be many more times." Mighty stood up and followed Jende to the kitchen sink where he washed his hands. After an hour and a half of fun, the Jungas hugged the Edwards boys goodbye and wished Vince a good time in India, and the Edwards boys thanked the Jungas for a really cool dinner party. As they were about to leave, Mighty remembered something.
"How's there going to be another time like this when Vince is leaving?"
he asked Nani.
"My mom and dad are never going to bring me here."
Smiling, Nani told him that he was going to have to take the subway and come all by himself then, which made Mighty grin. The idea of taking the subway alone from the Upper East Side to Harlem to have Cameroonian food must have sounded totally awesome. Chapter 26. It happened in the middle of September, around the time when the night air begins to ruthlessly wipe out memories of summer, and once happy chimes of ice cream trucks begin to sound like elegies. 2 weeks before it happened, he had a lifelike dream, the kind of dream he would remember in detail, even months after. He was back in Limburg, strolling through the market with his friend Bosco, who oddly was slender and tall, and looked nothing like the tree trunk of a man he was in real life. It was a market day, a Tuesday or a Friday. He could tell from how crowded the market was, and how slowly cars moved through it. Drivers impatiently honking and pushing their heads out of windows to swear at each other, screaming, "Come out for my front before I come jam box yam out. Yamamia, yamami pima." As they strolled past the brick store that sold chocolate spread, imported wine, and other luxurious foods, Bosco pointed out that there were no singing gamblers in the market that evening. Jende looked at the spot where the singing gamblers usually gathered. Next to the women selling jabaru and strong kanda and assorted smoked fishes. There was no one there. No men from some unknown place, wearing agbadas, beating djembe drums, and singing in perfect harmony as they tried to entice passersby to come spend a little bit of money to play games that could win them a whole lot of money. "I think they moved to another spot," Jende said. "Today is a market day. They cannot miss their chance to come on a day when everyone comes with big purses."
"I've never liked those singing gamblers," Bosco said, "but at least they're not half as bad as money doblers. I hate money doblers."
"You shouldn't hate anyone."
"But I hate them. I really hate money doblers," Bosco screamed,
his face suddenly, unpleasantly twisted like that of a child about to descend into a tantrum.
"My mother gave them my school fees to double so she could use the second part to pay for my sister's school fees, but they never brought the money back. My mother lost everything. That's why I never finished school. They stole my school fees."
"But it's your mother's fault for giving them the money."
"No, it's not her fault. It's the doubler's fault. They promised to double the money. They didn't double it. They took it and spent it and left us with nothing."
Bosco sat down on the sidewalk and began wailing. Jende tried to calm him down by rubbing his shoulders, but he refused to be consoled, pushing away Jende's hands and hysterically crying and cursing the money doublers over and over. A crowd gathered around him, asking what was wrong. "Money doublers, money doublers," he cried. The crowd started laughing.
"Stupid man, he did cry like small baby," they said. "Money doblers. Them know how for talk sweet talk. If they want we money, we go give them."
"No," Bosco begged. "Don't give your money to money doublers. Money doublers are bad people. God will punish them. They will have everlasting diarrhea for what they did to my mother. They will never sleep at night again. Their children will all die horrible deaths."
Embarrassed, unsure of how to get the crowd to leave his friend alone, Jende began running. He ran through the market, elbowing a girl with a tray of yellow peppers on her head and a burly man carrying yards of fabric on his shoulders. The wind was pushing against him as if to prevent him from going forward, as if to stop him from deserting his friend and leaving him a carcass for mockers. But he pushed against it, running faster than a man fleeing salivating wildcats, hoping to see the ocean and be relieved by the sight of it. Finally, out of breath, he got to the beach, but there was no water there, only a pile of garbage in its place, foul smelling and stretching to the horizon. He woke up, sweating. While showering that morning, he thought about the dream and decided that it was because he hadn't kept his promise to Bosco. Bosco had called him 2 months earlier asking for money to take his wife to see a specialist at Bingo Baptist Hospital for pain and swelling in her right breast. The doctor at the government hospital at Mile One hadn't been able to explain what was wrong with the breast, and Bosco's wife had been crying incessantly for days, unable to move her right hand.
"The bobby de like say you don't already start rotting for inside," Bosco had said, his voice breaking as his wife screamed in the background.
Jende had promised to see what he could do. He had done nothing. The night before his dream, he'd spoken to Sapo, who told him that death was coming for Bosco's wife any day now. The dream was therefore his guilt manifesting, Jende decided. He thought about calling Bosco to see what he could do, but there was no credit on his calling card. Besides, He didn't think he had any kind of money that could save Bosco's wife, and he had to rush to work. At work, he continued thinking about the dream as he drove Mighty and Stacy to a playdate, about what else it could mean. Maybe one of his friends back home had given money to a money doubler. It wouldn't surprise him if that were the case. People didn't learn, even after all the stories that circulated around Limbe, of how money doublers had deceived Ma this or Pa that. Why couldn't people learn? He asked himself. By all accounts, no one in Limbe had ever given money to a money doubler and gotten the money doubled. No one had ever given money and gotten any money back. And yet people continued to give to them, falling into the trap of crafty young men who walked up to them on the street and visited them in their homes, promising quick and high returns on their money through incomprehensible means. One woman at Sapa Road had been so enraptured by the two charming men in suits who visited her at home that she'd given them all of her life savings for double the money in 3 months' time. Her hope, the story around Limbe went, was that she would use the doubled money to buy a ticket for her only son to move to America. But the doublers did not return on the appointed day, or the day after, or the month after. Destroyed, the woman had eaten rat poison and died, leaving the son to bury her. By the time Jende woke up on the day Lehman collapsed, he had pushed the dream and Bosco to the hinterland of his mind. He was thinking nothing of money doublers and their unfathomable victims, merely glad he didn't have to go to work on a Monday. Cindy had given him the day off, telling him Clark would be too busy in the office to go anywhere, and assuring him that she and Mighty would be fine in cabs, considering she had only one appointment and Mighty's piano teacher was on vacation. Jende thankfully accepted Cindy's gift. A weekday off would be great for him. With Leomi at school, he could spend some alone time with Nenny and help her around the house, clean the bathroom, do laundry, and if he had enough time, cook and freeze a couple of meals so Nenny wouldn't have to worry about cooking until at least the following week. Her back had been aching unceasingly since she returned from the Hamptons, and he'd asked her to stop working and take only the minimum number of classes needed to retain her student visa. Pregnant women are not supposed to do anything strenuous in their last months, he'd said to her, even though his mother had continued farming to the day she gave birth to each of her five children, and had in fact given birth to his youngest brother under a guava tree at their farm behind Mawo Quarters.
But I like to work, Nenny had protested,
berating herself for days after she'd called the agency to say she wouldn't be available to work for a few months. Work will be there for you when you are ready, he assured her. He listened patiently whenever she began a piteous and long-winded rant about how being pregnant and not working made her feel fat and lazy and worthless, told her to remember how much she sometimes hated her job, and guaranteed her that not working was the best decision because her health was the most important thing. I'll go out there and work four jobs before I let you go to work in pain and discomfort, he promised her. A week after she quit her job, he took his dedication to her a step further and informed her that she was going to take off the upcoming spring and summer semesters and stay home after the baby arrived in December.
No,
she immediately responded, standing up from the sofa where they'd been cuddling.
I'm not taking off any time from school.
I've already thought about it and decided, he calmly informed her,
leaning back on the sofa and crossing his legs.
You've decided, eh?
She said, glaring at him, hands akimbo, as he picked up the remote control and turned on the TV.
What do you mean, you've decided? When did you decide this? You know I don't like this. I don't like it one bit when you decide something about me without asking me. I'm not your child.
You are my wife, and you are carrying my child, he said without looking at her,
leisurely clicking the remote control as if he and his wife were discussing what to have for dinner.
I want my wife to stay home with my new child for some time.
Why?
I think it's going to be best for you and the baby.
What about what I think is best?
She retorted, angry at him for making a decision about her life without consulting her, and even worse, for forcing her to add another year to the time it would take her to become a pharmacist.
How can you decide I'm taking off 2 semesters without asking me if it's going to make me happy?
You are going to stay home with the baby for a few months, he said again, the finality of his decision evident in his tone. Babies need to start their lives in the hands of their mother, and I want you to enjoy the baby while you're recovering from the pregnancy.
Nobody needs to recover from pregnancy, and I can't take off 2 whole semesters.
I've already decided.
I don't want to. You know I can't.
Yes, you can.
I can't. You know I'm going to fall out of status and lose my visa. And then what?
She wasn't going to fall out of status, he told her. He'd already discussed the matter with Boubacar, who was going to help them do what they needed to do so the International Students Office at BMCC would approve her for a medical leave of absence. I can't believe you're doing this to me, she cried as he continued clicking the channel buttons on the remote control, unable to find anything interesting to watch and unmoved by her tears. Why can't I at least take the minimum number of classes I need for my visa, like I'm doing now? Why are you always acting as if you own me? Having anticipated her reaction, he ignored her, making it clear he'd thought about the matter for days and wasn't going to change his mind. Ultimately, she grew quiet and went to bed defeated, because there was nothing she could do. He had brought her to America. He paid her tuition. He was her protector and advocate. He made decisions for their family. Sometimes he conferred with her about his decisions. Most times, he did what he deemed best. Always, she had no choice but to obey. That was what he expected of her. As her feet grew wider and her belly longer, her complaints to her friends about his behavior multiplied. There were too many things he wanted her to do or not do for both her and the child's well-being. He insisted she eat the salmon and sardine dinners he made for her, she said, because he'd read in one of Mrs. Edwards' discarded magazines that they were good for pregnant women and that fetuses whose mothers ate oily fishes grew up to be intelligent adults. He wanted her to please wash her lettuce well before making salad, because what if there were harmful germs on the leaves? She couldn't wear heels anymore for fear he was going to dive into a tirade about how she might hurt herself and the baby. And was it worth risking an unborn child's life just so she could look good? It was as if she had become an egg that might break at any minute. And you gonna complain about that, why? Fatou said to her. Betty and Olu, another friend from school, said the same thing. Why are you making noise when he's only looking out for you, they said. You said you suffered the last 2 times when you were pregnant and gave birth while living in your father's house, Betty reminded her. And now that your husband is treating you like a queen so you don't suffer again, you're grumbling? If you like a hard life so much, come and take my life, and I'll take yours for the next few months. Eventually, shamefully, she decided to defer to his wisdom, knowing that few women, rich women included, had the privilege of being married to an overly protective man who not only did everything he could to ensure his wife's comfort, but also spent hours wiping the dust-covered walls of their apartment and killing the roaches that sprinted from one end of the living room to the other like track and field athletes, all so he could protect the health of his unborn child. Though she could neither understand nor appreciate his decision about her taking 2 semesters off, she slowly allowed herself to feel no guilt about being a housewife in a city full of independent women, and not being, at least for a while, a successful career woman like Oprah or Martha Stewart. She decided to enjoy the unwanted privilege of sitting at home all day, watching too many hours of talk shows and sitcoms and breaking news, which was what she was doing on the Monday morning the news came up on CNN.
Jende?
She called from the living room.
Jendeo!
Eh?
He replied, running out of the bedroom where he was folding the clean clothes he'd just brought back from the laundromat. Her panicked voice made him nervous. Every time she called his name like that, he feared it had to do with the baby.
Watch,
she said, pointing to the TV.
Something about Lehman Brothers. Is that not where Mr. Edwards works?
Yes, it was, he said, not yet panicking, not wanting to think that the news had anything to do with what Leah had been dreading.
He heard a journalist say that the collapse was a massive earthquake that would reverberate across the world for months to come. He heard another journalist talk about the catastrophic fall in stock prices and the possibility of a recession. A former employee of Lehman Brothers was interviewed. She hadn't seen this coming, she said. People were suspicious, but no one thought it was really going to come to this. They'd been told just today that it was over. She had no idea what she was going to do. No one knew what they were going to do now. Nenny placed her hand on her chest.
"Does it mean Mr. Edwards has no job now?" she asked.
Neither of them asked the next question. Did it mean Jende would have no job too? The fear within them could not let loose the words. Similar questions would burrow into the minds of many in New York City in the coming weeks. Many would be convinced that the plague that had descended on the homes of former Lehman employees was only a few blocks from theirs. Restaurateurs, artists, private tutors, magazine publishers, foundation directors, limousine drivers, nannies, housekeepers, employment agencies, virtually everyone who stood along the path where money flowed to and from the street, fretted and panicked that day. For some, the fears were justified. Their bread and wine would indeed disappear, along with the billions of dollars that vanished the day Lehman died.
"I have to call Mr. Edwards,"
Jende said, hurriedly picking up his cell phone from the dinette table. Clark did not answer his cell phone, but Cindy did when he called the house number.
"You still have a job?"
she said to him.
"Oh, thank you, madame. Thank you so much."
"Nothing's changing," she said. "Clark's going to call you to let you know when to come back to work," she added, before quickly getting off the phone to take another call. Jende placed the cell phone on the table and sat down next to Nenny. He was dizzy, grateful, but stunned. It had just dawned on him how tightly his fate was linked to another man's. What if something ever happened to Mr. Edwards? His work permit was set to expire in March, and he might not be able to renew it again, depending on how his court case went. Without working papers, he would never be able to get another job that paid as much. How would he take care of a wife and two children? How many restaurant dishwashing jobs would he have to do for cash?
"Please, let's not think like that," Nenny said. "You have a job for now, eh? As long as we have Mr. Edwards, we have a job. Are we not better off today than all those people walking out of Lehman? Look at them. I just feel so sorry for them. But then, we don't know what's on the road coming for us, too. We just don't know. So, let's only be happy that today we were spared."
Chapter 27. Neither of them said much to the other on the first day they spent together after Lehman fell. There wasn't much to say, and there was certainly too little time to say it, with Clark sighing and hammering on his laptop as if the keys were obstinate. He seemed to have gotten older by 10 years in 7 days, a deep crease suddenly evident on his forehead, and Jende couldn't stop wondering why the man was doing this to himself. Why, with all the money he'd made, he couldn't pick up and go live a quiet, stress-free life somewhere far away from New York City. That's what he would do if he were in Mr. Edwards' position. By the time he was close to being a millionaire, he would give suffering a firm handshake and tell it goodbye. Why should a man intentionally live his life with one kind of anxiety followed by another? But men like Clark Edwards did not think like that, it appeared. It didn't seem to be about the money anymore. His life on Wall Street, as suffocating as it was, appeared to be what was giving him air.
"I am very sorry, sir,"
Jende finally forced himself to say 10 minutes after they'd been in the car together, as they drove to Clark's new workplace at Barclays, the British giant that had swallowed up Lehman after it was declared legally dead.
"Thanks," Clark said without looking up from his laptop. "I hope everyone will be okay, sir."
"Eventually."
Jende knew what the curt response meant. Stop talking. So he did precisely that. He kept his eyes on the road and drove in silence for the rest of the week. from the Sapphire apartment building on the Upper East Side to Barclays in Midtown East, or the Lehman-turned-Barclays office tower on 7th Avenue. From a meeting with ex-Lehman executives to a meeting with Barclays executives. From a lunch with Treasury officials in Washington, D.C., to a dinner with lawyers at a Long Island steakhouse. Clark said little to him except for quick greetings or orders to hurry up, or reminders to return by a certain time after picking up Cindy or dropping off Mighty. Once he barked at Jende to cut around another car, but most days he sweated in the back seat, mumbling to himself when he wasn't on the phone, moving from one end of the seat to the other, speaking in rushed, anxious tones to various people, flipping through piles of papers, opening and closing his laptop, opening and closing the Wall Street Journal, scribbling on his notepad. Jende understood nothing of what he heard him say. After months of educating himself with the journal, he'd come to understand the concept of buying low and selling high, but the things Clark was talking about these days, things like derivatives and regulations, ratings and overrated junk, were indecipherable. The only things decipherable in his voice were misery and exhaustion. "You should have seen him the night it happened," Cindy said to Cherie as Jende drove them to Stamford to visit Cherie's mother. "I've never seen him that scared." "Of course he would be," Cherie said. "Everything he worked for just went down the drain. And Lehman, of all companies, I was speechless. You, me, and the whole world." "For some reason, these things keep happening when I'm out of the country. 9/11 I was out, Oklahoma City I was out, this one I was out."
"Maybe that's not such a bad thing," Cindy said. "Sometimes it's better to be far away from the center of the madness."
"No," Cherie said. "I'd rather be home. There's nothing pleasant about running across Florence so you can get back to your hotel room and stare at the TV, watching what's happening in your country. I'd rather be home and go to sleep scared in my own bed."
"I guess."
"I tried to call you the moment I landed last night."
"I know. I'm sorry. I wasn't in a talking mood, but I sent you a text. Didn't you see it?"
"No, I didn't see any text. If you hadn't called this morning, I would have taken the train alone. I figured you'd probably changed your mind with everything that's going on."
"Oh, no. I need this," Cindy said.
"I need to get out of the city. It's just too much."
"It is. I would have left yesterday for a long weekend alone, but Mighty and I have a movie and dinner date on Saturday, and I need to help him prepare for his youth orchestra audition. Besides, I promised your mom I was going to come back. I need to get my mind off myself for a little bit. It's just been awful. Clark has been so hard to be around."
"He must have looked like crap when it happened," Cherie said. And Cindy nodded. Clark had returned home early from work two nights before, she told Cherie, around 9 o'clock. He took off his shirt and sat on the edge of the bed with his head bowed, his bare back humped like that of a man waiting for a load to descend. He did not move or speak, not even when she came in, said hello, and climbed into bed. She had an early morning appointment for a mammogram and needed a good rest, so she wasn't in the mood for small talk, which was why she hadn't asked him why he was just sitting there like that, somber and mute and motionless. Instead, she had picked up the New Yorker. She hadn't had a chance to read the profile of Obama, and flipped it open. "Lehman is going to file for bankruptcy," he'd said abruptly, his head still bowed. She'd gasped, dropping the magazine and covering her mouth with her hand. She sat up in the bed, staring at the back of his head. "You heard me right," he said without turning to face her. "They'd done everything. The company couldn't be saved. The announcement would be coming within days. They were still trying to fight it, hold on to it, but..." He shook his head.
"The poor thing," Cherie said. "I had no idea what to do or say to him," Cindy went on.
All she could do was gasp again as it sunk in. She looked at her hands. She hadn't realized they were shivering. A thousand questions were rushing through her mind. How much were they going to lose? What were they going to do if they lost too much? What was going to happen to his career? Was he okay? What was he feeling? How was this possible? Was there a chance the Fed would make a last-minute decision to intervene and prevent the bankruptcy? They intervened with BS, didn't they? She wanted to move close and hold him, so they could be together in their fear. But she couldn't be certain he wanted or needed any of it. So she slid to the edge of the bed and sat beside him. "Did you know any of this?" Cherie asked. "That it was this bad?" "Not really," Cindy said. She had known of the struggles at Lehman, but not in detail. Certainly not how close it was to its end. He had told her only that the company was treading perilous waters, and asked her to understand when he had to cancel plans in order to work. But how was she to know that the times he did it over the summer were any different from all the other times when she'd had to cancel dinner plans and postpone vacations and attend parties alone because he had to work? "That's the danger of dealing with workaholics," Cherie said. "It's hard to trust them." "Welcome to my life," Cindy said mournfully. "Or whatever's left of it." "Everything's going to be all right, Cindy. We'll be all right. Sean has to constantly remind me too. He says I have to stop checking our portfolios 20 times a day, but I can't help it. I woke up every morning in Florence panicking about losing everything. Of course, I call Sean to talk and he's sleeping. I have no idea how he still sleeps so peacefully at night. I don't think I've slept more than 4 hours any night all week." Cindy did not immediately respond. She seemed lost in a maze of 100 thoughts. "I wish I had Sean's calmness," she finally said. "Nothing ever seems to unravel him." "Yeah, but you won't believe what he suggested to me yesterday," Cherie said.
"What?"
"He thinks maybe we should get rid of Rosa for a few months to save."
"Are you kidding me? Was he serious?"
Cherie laughed.
"Incredible," she said. "I didn't even deign to respond when he said it."
"Yeah, that's exactly what we need now, right?" Cindy said. "To be cooking and cleaning and doing laundry while we're losing money and sleep? That would be wonderful."
The women laughed together.
"But it's scary how bad this could get," Cherie said,
her tone turning serious as their laughter ebbed.
"When people start talking about flying coach and selling vacation homes..."
"It's scary, but Anna's not going anywhere, no matter how bad it gets or what everyone else starts doing to survive. I don't know what I would ever do without her."
"Rosa's not going anywhere either. I guess we just have to be hopeful that everything's going to be all right, as ugly as it seems."
Cindy agreed. That was what Clark had said too, she said. When she'd asked him that night if the impending bankruptcy was going to hurt the economy, he'd said that yes, he believed the economy was going to get really bad. Everything was about to change, one way or another, for everyone in the country, at least for some time. "When a powerful house like Lehman falls," he'd told her, "people start questioning if indeed there is power in the other houses." There was going to be panic in the market, portfolios losing up to half of their values, lots of crazy stuff that could destroy the investments and livelihood of millions of good, innocent people. It could be very bad. But they were going to be okay. The likes of them were going to lose money in the short term, but they were going to be okay, sooner rather than later, unlike those poor devils on the streets.
"I hope he's right," Cherie said. "And I really hope he's going to be okay soon."
"I don't know," Cindy said after a pause. "We haven't spoken much since that night. He's so stressed out and short-fused, I'm almost afraid of saying anything. I went 3 days without seeing him last week."
"He's got to be very busy transitioning to Barclays."
"I know, and that's what he says, but you never know. I hope it's only that and not also because..."
"Come on, Cindy."
It's at times like this, Cher, Cindy whispered. This is when they start turning to those... She cut herself short, perhaps realizing Jende might be listening, which he was, intently.
You've got to stop.